Hello everyone, and since we've just been through the Armada and of course Elizabeth's famous Tilbury speech on the History of England podcast, it just so happens that I got to talking on Twitter to a guy called Sean Lang, a lecturer and educator who also teaches history through drama. Now, it just so happens that Sean had written some really fun things to do with the way the Tilbury speech was represented in films through the years. So very kindly, he agreed to come on the podcast and tell us all about it. There are some short clips in here and what follows, which I put in subsequently. But also, if you go to the post on the website, thehistoryofengland.co.uk, you can see some clips of the speech from YouTube. But anyway, here we go. Hello, everybody, and welcome to a special episode of The History of England. I'm very lucky to have been joined today by Sean Lang. Sean, tell everybody all about yourself.
I lecture in history at Anglia Ruskin University, which is, at least the history part of it, is in Cambridge. I was for many years a school teacher. And did a lot of work in the Historical Association as well. And it might be relevant to this because I also do a lot of theatre writing and looking at the way in which you can present the past on stage, which relates very much to what we're going to be talking about today about history on film.
It's a fantastic thing. I saw your website and I love the idea of, which we've kind of lost a bit, it seems to me, of telling stories through theatre and through drama about history and educating in that way. We've got quite serious about history. So I thought your site was great.
It's a very interesting exercise, particularly if you are a historian rather than someone who's sort of using history because you're basically a playwright or whatever. Because I think if you're a historian, you have a certain sort of loyalty to, what should we call it, the truth or accuracy, let's call it that, you know, in a way that, you know, many script writers don't feel. And so they sort of will take all sorts of liberties. And I think trying to get that balance between what is practical, particularly on the stage, when, you know, if you're going to have everyone who was actually present in the past, that's another actor, another costume. It's a lot of, you know, a lot of money.
Yes.
And also you've got to give them something to say. Otherwise, it's not much fun to come up every night for a play just to stand it looking pretty in the background. But also, it's an interesting thing about a character. What I mean is that anyone in the past, most part they're dead. So their character, we have to sort of reconstruct from what they left behind. And then when you're writing a piece of drama or whatever, then in a sense, what you do is you create another person. So you have the historical person, you have the interpretation of the historical person, you have the presentation of that by the script. And then of course you have the actor as well, who interprets it as well. So the relationship between the person you see on stage or on a screen and the real historical character has gone through an awful lot of stages of interpretation to come down to the person. And of course what you have to bear in mind, and this is really true once you get it on the screen, is that most people will assume that the thing or the person they're seeing or hearing is the real one.
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it kind of relates also, doesn't it, to this thing about, you know, what is the truth? And let's not get into this too much, but, you know, that people see the same event in very different ways, and even the practicalities of the event are often very different. So what you're describing, I suppose, is a fundamental problem of all history writing of any type.
Absolutely. And when you're looking at it in a sort of drama setting, the other thing you have to bear in mind is the role of a director or a producer who has to produce something which looks right, you know, to an audience. And therefore, and this is why in film, certainly nowadays, they're usually are pretty good at getting the look right, partly because we have a much better understanding, you know, knowledge of what periods in the past look like. You can check on Google Images if you have any doubts in that case in the way that you couldn't before. They often go to a lot of trouble to get that right. But as for what historians might think of as the rather more important stuff about, what people said or how people were, or even actually details of costume, they won't worry about that because what they want is a package, is a product that they can sell, as it were, to an audience. Now, there's a very interesting contrast between the way you still package when you're writing history, but your priorities are very different. And I suppose your audience is usually fairly different as well.
it seems to me a selection of what you write about it also, is also an incredibly easy way for historians to affect what they write. You just leave stuff out because you can't cover everything.
Exactly.
Yeah. You've immediately affected the story. Anyway, enough. That's not what I talk about. But related to what you're talking about, your drama, you had this great idea, which we talked about on Twitter, of all places, of how Elizabeth I's famous Tilbury speech about at the time of the Armada, how that's been reinterpreted in film in different ways.
That's right, because I used to, well, we had a course at Anglia Ruskin called Film and History, and this was really trying to get students to be very aware, to be, if you like, I suppose the word might be literate, sort of historically literate, in looking both at historical film and at the way in which history is presented on film. And of course, there's an area which is very much relevant to this, where you have both, where you have the way history was presented back in the past. And I had this idea of taking exactly the same historical moment and seeing how that same moment was presented in different film versions. I have to confess, I can't remember how I latched onto the Elizabeth's Tilbury speech, but it's because there's a lot of films made about Elizabeth, and indeed, you know, continue to be made, and it's such a big moment in her story. You know, I suppose there are one or two others, I suppose, from the Second World War or from Nelson or something like that, where you might have got the same, but this is what I latched onto. Mm-hmm. And immediately I discovered that there really is such a difference between the way in which the same moment is presented, that really, in a sense, what you're looking at is how different periods of our recent past have seen themselves by using history as a sort of mirror.
Which relates exactly to what we're talking about, wasn't it? You know, there is no one history.
Yeah.
And I suppose postmodernists would say, is there a history at all? But anyway, let's not get into that again. Okay, so that's very good. Can you tell us a little bit about the provenance of the Tilbury speech?
This is from the time of the Armada, when there was and very important to get on board here, that the threat of a Spanish invasion, although we know that the Armada was sort of blown to pieces by the winds and by English action, what have you, they didn't know that. And the danger and the sheer size of the army just over the water, relatively easy to transport it. And if they did, they'd head for London and go up the Thames estuary, which is why Tilbury in Essex was, it sounds a bit strange, but actually it was the front line. At a time when, again, the army had Philip landed, we're talking about something like, you know, Hitler's Wehrmacht. It was absolutely massive, very, very powerful. This is a real emergency. And the Queen made very good use of her own presence in the way that she was very good at doing. She'd been on the throne for, for nearly 30 years by then. In fact, exactly 30 years. And she presented herself to her troops as a sort of propaganda coup, boost morale, really sort of put some heart into them. This is the sort of thing that she did. Now, the speech itself is very famous. You can, certainly one or two phrases from it are often quoted. This is the one which has got that famous phrase about, I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a prince, of a king, and a king of England too, blah, blah, blah. Okay. How do we know that she said it? And this is always the case for any speech before the age of recording, so in other words, for most of history, you're reliant entirely upon written records of what was said. When you have someone getting up, as you'd have, for example, later on in Parliament, where they very often have the speech written out in front of them, and you've got people taking down a verbatim report, then we can be fairly sure that what we've got is pretty close to what was said. But that's not the case here. So what you tend to get with major speeches, particularly when, as in this case, they're done for propaganda purposes, is what you might call an official version, which is written out and either at the time or, of course, very often, slightly later. And in the case of this one, this seems to have been certainly an official version which was given out later. So we don't know if that's actually what she said. But what we can say is that it's certainly in line and is sort of in character with the way she expressed herself. It's absolutely in line with the way in which she made use of her womanly sort of body and image. And since it it propaganda was needed. It's a very good, powerful piece of propaganda. So although we can't be certain it's the exact words, I think we can be fairly confident rather than certain, that it will almost certainly be very close to the sort of message that in those circumstances she would have wanted to give.
Great. OK. And before we go on, actually, my favourite version of the speech, I think, might be the Horrible Histories one, where she says, I have the heart and body of a king, and the king would like it back, please.
That's rather good. You can always rely on them.
So let's, without more ado, let's start talking about the various films. I think what I might do, just for information, Sean, and to everybody listening, actually, that I'll stitch some bits of the speeches in just to give people a flavour, but we don't have that here, so I'll do that later. So we start with Flora Robson.
Yes, this is 1936.
Right.
Film made in Hollywood called Fire Over England. It's mainly a sort of romantic swashbuckling film starring Laurence Olivier and Vivien Leigh. And in fact, this is the film where Vivien Leigh was spotted and then brought in to play the lead in Gone with the Wind. But Queen Elizabeth is quite an important sort of supporting role, if you like, in the film. And one of the big set pieces is indeed the Armada speech. So certainly one thing I read about this was that in the original version of the screenplay, they had simply put some words together. And Flora Robson had done a bit of reading and had come across the text of the speech. And she's basically sort of turned up and said, hey, look, I've got a better thing. I've got the actual speech.
Right.
So what you have there is what you might call the absolutely standard version. You've got all the soldiers gathering. There's a lot of extras there, a lot of extra actors, that is to say, they're in costume. Interestingly, because this is a trope that seems to come up every time, you see her riding on horseback with her sort of generals and people coming over a sort of ridge and then down to where the troops are. They all seem to begin with that as to sort of establish the shot. And then she's on her horse with the soldier standing around, and she gives a speech. Now, the Lady Bird book of Queen Elizabeth, which I remember having as a child.
We love the Lady Bird books.
Lady Bird, that's right. And that particular one, is one of the earliest of the Lady Bird history titles. And I think I might say it was published in the 1950s. It is absolutely clear that the illustration in that is based on the image in Fire Over England. And indeed, it's on the cover of the Lady Bird book. So that's what I mean by the version which becomes the standard one, because there's a whole generation, mm-hmm. part of it, that grew up with that sort of imagery. Mm. Now, wait a minute, I mentioned this is 1936. 1936 is also the time when there was a real fear abroad in Europe about the possibility of another war, and that this war was going to be a lot, lot worse even than the First World War, of course, which they all remembered. 1936 is also the year of the film version of H.G. Wells's Things to Come, and that gives this terrifying image of death coming from the skies, of a sun, which is blotted out by the sheer number of evil-looking aircraft. Very similar to an image from a film just a few years later, 1939, which is The Wizard of Oz, with the flying monkeys coming over. That fear of death coming from the skies, which, of course, had literally happened in the case of Italian bombing in Abyssinia, was going to come with... And it came in 1936 with German bombing in Spain, and would come, of course, in 1939 with German bombing in Poland. So this is a world where there's a real fear of the idea of foreign or indeed alien invasion. Again, it's the time of the H.G. Wells and Orson Welles' version, the famous radio version of his War of the Worlds with alien invasion. So invasion fears actually speak more directly to an audience in 1936 than just learning about the Armada. And the idea that you should be able to sort of stand up to them, that you should defy the evil foreign enemy who dares to invade your realm, is a very potent one in 1936. Right. And I suppose, if the story that Flora Robson told of how she sort of substituted what we'll call the original text for the screenplay is right, that in itself is significant, because directors don't usually do that sort of thing on set. But the power of the speech was clearly good box office, and the film was, you know, was very well received, particularly in England, because it sort of had a resonance for the 1930s. This is using the image of England standing up to a foreign dictator, if you like, who controls all of Europe. I know we're not quite at the sort of stage of Hitler's big power, but the potential of that is there by 1936, no question. And it's therefore not just a patriotic type of image, it's a very reassuring one. And it makes a lot more sense when you place it into its 1930s context than it does if you just sort of say, here's a history, you know, and this is about the Tudors. It's about the Tudors, yes, but actually it's about the 1930s as well.
Very interesting. So I noticed that compared to the others, in a way, the response of the troops is very straightforward. It's very patriotic, very enthusiastic. There's no social realism there. It's all, you know, let's go, Queen, as it were.
Absolutely, yes. It is. And that's and if you sort of compare it with a film, an actual Shakespeare film made, it's 1944, but this is Henry V. Olivia again, right. And the big we're recording this on St. George's Day, so it's very appropriate, to reference this, because in the famous speech before the Battle of Agincourt, the imagery is similar. Again, lots of soldiers stand around listening intently, straightforward cheers for the king. You know, Fire of England is not a Shakespeare film, but it's very much in the way in which that period, the Shakespeare period, is used. And of course, Henry V starts that lovely sequence, which is Shakespeare's London, Elizabeth's London. And then sort of the scene sort of changes and you actually have the medieval one. So I think there's a way in which the Tudor period is sort of referenced in the 30s. And the Americans, incidentally, very much buy into this. And of course, it's made in Hollywood as a period of English stability and security and cultural wealth and richness. You know, in other words, the very much the Golden Age.
Right.
But in the Golden Age, which is particularly in the case of the Armada, is under threat from a dark force, but it sees it off. And this is the sort of very patriotic thing which Americans can buy into because they see it as their heritage as well. This is still the time when, although so many Americans don't have an English heritage, but the official version of Americanism is that England is the mother country. That's still the case in the 30s. So you can use the English history as your own heritage. And that's a sort of fusion of the Anglo-American idea. So very powerful, very simple type of history. As propaganda is a dirty word, but it is actually what it is. That is what it is. But you know, if you like, with a benign intent behind it.
Yeah. Brilliant. Thanks, Sean. Now let's have a little clip from the film that we've just been discussing from Flora Robson, so you know what Sean's been talking about.
Amongst you all, to lay down for my God and for my kingdom and for my people my honor and my blood, even in the dust. I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman, but I have the heart and valor of a king, and of a king of England too. Not Spain nor any prince of Europe shall dare to invade the borders of my realm. Pluck up your hearts. By your peace in camp and your valor in the field, we shall shortly have a famous victory.
Thank you, Flora Robson. So what was the next version to come out?
Next version I looked at was leaping ahead to the early 70s, and we're now getting into the time that I remember from my sort of own youth. And this was Glenda Jackson as Queen Elizabeth in the BBC 2 series, Elizabeth R. which interestingly has recently been repeated on.
Yes, I saw that actually. It really took me back. Fantastic. Yeah. BBC dramas, because similar time they had I, Claudius, didn't they?
Claudius, yeah, a little bit later in the decade. Elizabeth R. followed, but I suppose the next big history one would be the adaptation of War and Peace, which I think we're looking at the same sort of time, 71, 72, that sort of time. And then I, Claudius, I think is sort of 76, 77, Elizabeth. Yeah, this is the time of the BBC's big prestige drama. And BBC Two is central to this because this is the time when BBC television is still very, very much under the Lord Reith mantle and I was going to say shadow. I mean, shadow sounds a bad thing. I don't mean it's a bad thing, but it's still very heavily influenced by that ideal. And the launch of BBC Two was very much seen as a way in which the BBC could separate its populist BBC One role. Where, of course, it was in direct competition with ITV, which was the brash newcomer from the 50s, and could sort of hive off its more culturally, culturally picky audience on BBC yeah. Two. Now, the BBC here has a sort of role to educate. And I would put these big, and I mean big, in the sense that they were long. We're talking about series of 13 episodes, 26 episodes, things like that. The big prestige documentaries, like the famous one is Kenneth Clark's Civilization. Mm-hmm. But other ones like Jacob Bronowski, the Ascent of Man. There was one which actually is worth talking about for another occasion, which was, again, a long series on the British Empire. Made in 1969, 1970. And these things would come out with publications to go with them. Sometimes you'd have a big sort of weighty book, Civilization and the Ascent of Man, both had little, at the end of the decade, a little bit later, you got the same thing for David Attenborough and Life on Earth. Or if there wasn't a book, then maybe a magazine or a series of magazines. These things, you know, the BBC publications went along with these and they gave it a sort of educational weight. And absolutely the same was true with Elizabeth R. The opening was a lovely piece of animation which showed her signature sort of going around with all the decoration, you see, really sort of announcing that we've got an important piece of history television here. And in fact, it was very like the opening sequence of Chronicle, which was BBC Two's history documentary series, which again began with a big letter C and lots of decoration, very, very similar to the Elizabeth R. Opening. Glenda Jackson really made her name. She was already a sort of highly regarded actress, but this sort of established her as sort of acting royalty, as it were. Mm. When she appeared on Morecambe and Wise, it's exactly because she had that and they sort of bowed to her as she came in, you see. Now, the bad news I've got is that when you look back to these often fondly remembered BBC series from the 1970s, the style of television has changed massively and we have changed in our tastes, possibly without realising it. So for one thing, of course, they're all studio shot. Secondly, the pace was a lot slower than we used to. Mm. You know, Call of Duty, this ain't. You need to get used to that. Yeah. And the emphasis was still very theatrical, and the emphasis was upon the sort of great actor performing. So when you come to this particular episode, you know, and look for the Armada speech, you have you've got the what we're calling the original version. It's in a fuller version than Flora Robson. Because it's treated almost like a Shakespearean speech. And there is a close-up of her, her face. And there are two soldiers. This time, as you said, they don't sort of home in on the extras in the 1930s. They do in the 70s. Because, of course, we've got a little touch of the more democratic politics, if you like. I have to say that the dialogue between the two soldiers is a bit stilted. There's old grizzled soldier, and there's young greenhorn soldier, and the old grizzled soldier says, bread, you know. Oh, there she is, there's the wonderful lady up there. All of that. But hey, it's a nod towards the sort of more human side. This, after all, is also only a couple of years after the famous Royal Family documentary had gone out. So we'd seen Queen Elizabeth II sort of as a real person, not just a figure at a distance. But the emphasis here is really on highbrow, high culture. This, if you like, is good for you. Sit down. It's got same sort of didactic, slightly snooty side to it, I suppose, that Radio 3 tended to have at that time as well. Yes. You know, this is good for you. This is with the BBC. This is high culture. Sit down at the back there. Someone's not listening. They know who they are, you know. And I have to say, and I was really surprised when I looked back at these, because I was, about 10, 11, dead keen on history at the time, as the time when these came out. I used to watch Chronicle. When we had a reunion after 10 years for my primary school, when I was a student, and they said, oh, sure, we remember you. You were the one who used to come in really excited and talk about something that had been on telly the night before on BBC Two. You know, they remember me.
Yes.
So I have very fond memories of this. But when I look back at it, I have to confess, this is the one I found difficult to watch because it was so slow. It was so stilted. It was so stagey, old-fashioned Oxbridge drama type of feel to it.
It is almost like a play on film, as it were, you know, like watching, I don't know, Play for the Debt for Today or those other things that happened at the same time. It's not cinematic, is it?
No, it's not. And of course, they get all the costumes right. But unfortunately, and this is where your director would sort of look at it and say, I don't want anything like that. And the costumes look right, but they don't look exciting. And the whole thing is very much, dare I say, it's got a touch of BBC Two Open University. Because at that time, the Open University went out on BBC Two. So BBC Two is associated with that high culture, didactic teaching, and much of the drama went in that way. And so this is the academic version, if you like, of Elizabeth Tilbury's speech in costume.
Right, very good, excellent. I have to say, I still rather enjoy those old things. Maybe I haven't moved on emotionally. I'd like to formally apologise for that. Okay, so that's the famous Glenda. Okay, everyone, let's just put a little clip from Glenda into this so that you can see what Sean was talking about.
I know I have the body of a weak and feeble woman.
Yeah, now she comes to it, now she cogs the dice.
I have the heart and stomach of a king, and a king of England too. And I think foul scorn that Parma or Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of our realm.
God's death, she breedeth courage in a man.
What I feel in my stomach is not courage.
Stand at my flank, my boy. And I'll show you how we fought the Dons at Zutphen.
Thank you, Glenda. Okay then, Sean, what comes next?
Well, next I want to ahead to the 1990s the Kate Blanchett version. Now, these are the two films that came out, Elizabeth and Elizabeth the Golden Age. And 1990s, we've moved on from the 70s. I know the 90s, well, to me, they seem like yesterday.
Yes.
You know, they are a world away from the 70s. I know to some people, they might think it's all sort of, you know, old history, but there's a big difference between the 70s and the 90s. And that 20 years, attitudes have changed so much. And in fact, the big change, in so many ways, and I'm here talking about attitudes in this context, particularly towards women and the role of women. There's a big change even between the 80s and the 90s. The change had come across very, very quickly. And obviously the feminist movement, or you can date feminism back to the 19th century and earlier, but what we think of as the modern feminist movement, late 60s in the States, certainly underway by the 70s in Britain. But the really big changes in terms of central mainstream media and presentation, I would say, is sort of 90s. And it's reflected very well in this film. Because in many ways, to make a film about Queen Elizabeth would seem a very traditional thing to do. As we've seen, you can trace this sort of thing back to the 30s. But the take on this is very different. This is a sort of kick-ass type of Elizabeth. And she sort of knocks heads together. She's a woman in a world of men. Now, this might seem a strange thing to add in, but of course, the idea of the woman who kicks ass in a world of men had been governing Britain through the 1980s. Of course, Mrs. Thatcher. Yes. I'm not making a big difference. I'm not making a big comparison between Mrs. Thatcher and Kate Blanchett. But the image of the woman in power, the powerful woman, the shoulder pads and the rest of it of the 1980s, carries through to the 90s. And it's very much that, the sort of Elizabeth that we see in that one. And so it's absolutely a much more assertive, a much more physical, less theatrical type of Elizabeth. She's not constrained, and indeed, again, the costumes sort of do that. She's not constrained by the Elizabethan authenticity that you have with Glenda Jackson. And the other thing I would mention, because there's no getting away from it when you look at the imagery of the Tilbury speech, is Lord of the Rings.
Yes.
It's never been a huge, big hit there. Effectively, what you have with this Elizabeth is a sort of warrior, sort of elvish warrior queen with the long hair. And this time, instead of being in the sort of the imagery that we have for Elizabeth in the previous ones, which is of her wearing a breastplate, so there's your sort of heart and stomach of a king, but the rest of her is very much a woman. She's got a dress, she's got a sort of jaunty hat on. There's no getting away from it. This is a woman in a male breastplate. Kate Blanchett is in armour from head to foot, but with long hair going down the back. This is a much more androgynous type of Elizabeth, if you like. It's still a young Elizabeth, whereas in actual fact, you know, but she was no longer young by the time of the Armada. But, you know, that doesn't suit the producer. So we go for a 90s woman. That's what that's what we have there. And as for the speech, well, the speech is not very PC, is it? This isn't no one was saying woke in the 1990s, but the idea was there. The idea of saying I have a body of a weak and feeble woman, I think not. So the speech just goes. And they just sort of invented a speech, sort of suitable words for a good sort of strong woman in a man's role type of speech. But the it's just completely invented by the scriptwriters.
Yes, I must admit, one of the things I think at some point she says they will not pass something. And given all the other imagery, as you've said, I kept on imagining there was going to be a Balrog would appear, or
that's right,
or you know Gandalf would say, "Fly, you fools!"
Sending his orcs in the So we're into a sort of fantasy world. And the other thing, actually, in the film, although it's not in this particular sequence, is the bishops, that when she wants to pass her religious changes of three right at the start of her reign, the bishops are all sort of locked up. It's related to what actually happened. But the bishops all wear black. They're in black robes, black hats, the whole lot. I mean, talk about colour coding. You know? These are the bad guys. Yes. And I think I can't remember if this is something I read at the time or if someone actually said it to me, and I hope memory plays tricks, but it's an American lady who saw the film and said, "Oh, wasn't she great? She really showed those bishops," you know. And I think you've got a very, very simple narrative which this one is portraying, and it's a narrative for the 90s, grown out of the 80s, but it's the 90s narrative, and it is about a woman can do whatever she wants, even in a male-dominated world. Look at Elizabeth. Now, Elizabeth's long been a role model, but the model itself was different in the 30s, different in the 70s, and different again in the 90s.
Fascinating. I also noticed, or seemed to notice, that the music had a big impact in a lot of these. The music in this one was very, very sort of stirring and martial in the background, as it were. It was much more obvious than the previous films.
Yes. And of course, in the Glenda Jackson, there isn't any music. Music, it's just the voice, the actor voice in the studio, in the theatre, really.
I suppose that veracity, as it were, rather than the cinematic drama of Kate Blanchett. Okay, then let's see what that sounds like before we move on to the next one.
people. We see the sails of the enemy approaching. We hear the Spanish guns over the water. Soon now, we will meet them face to face. I am resolved in the midst and heat of the battle to live or die amongst you all!
Ah, excellent, Kate. The powers of Mordor will perish. So what was the next one then, Sean?
And then I looked at the last one I looked at. In fact, there were two I looked at, but only one of them covered the Tilbury period, which is back to the BBC. But we're now into the 2000s. Now, there were two TV dramas about Elizabeth. One had Helen Mirren playing Elizabeth, and it was really about the Earl of Essex crisis. So it was right at the end of her reign, so it didn't have the Armada period. But the other one was The Virgin Queen, which had Anne-Marie Duff in the title role. Very interesting casting, because obviously she's Irish here playing a big, important Elizabeth, an English queen. And she very much made her name as a sort of feisty character. She was in the Magdalen Sisters, for example, but not an establishment type of figure at all. And here she is playing this Elizabeth. And I think with this one, even though it's relatively close chronologically to the Cate Blanchett one, but we have a totally different one again. When you go to the Armada scene, the Tilbury speech, in many ways we seem to be back where we began, because you have the same sort of imagery, the soldiers in the tents sort of down below, slight slope, they come, the Queen again with all her attendants and on horseback, they come over the top of the slope and then come down. It's very similar on the face of it to the Flora Robson version. But the whole setting, in dramatic terms, I mean, is different. First of all, very cleverly, what they do is, yes, they have her delivering the speech, but almost as if they sort of thought about the problem of authenticity that we talked about right at the start. Whilst the speech is still being delivered, they then cut to other people reading it out in the council, reading it out to people out in the country. So you get the idea of the propaganda use of the speech. And of course, in many ways, that's closer to actually the way the wording was used. So we got a little bit of the actual history sort of creeping in quite cleverly and making the point about the way in which the speech was used and the purpose of it. And now that, of course, makes very good television as well. And then the emphasis here is on Elizabeth as it's a much more intimate portrait of her as a person. I was going to say of her as a woman, but of course that's what we've just been talking about with the Cate Blanchett version. And it is Elizabeth as a woman, but central to this one is her relationship, her friendship with Robert Dudley, the Earl of Leicester. Mm. And in the course of this scene, you see her talking, chatting, banter, really, between her and Dudley, her old childhood friend, the relationship that was so close, couldn't happen, never quite did happen. It's a very interesting, sort of dramatically, it's a very interesting relationship between the two of them. It's not straightforward Romeo and Juliet at all. Mm. It's something in many ways much deeper than that, much more interesting than a straightforward love relationship. Mm. And in fact, in the course of it, you know, Dudley, you know, sort of falls asleep in the way that you do, and you're that much older in life and tired and all the rest of it. And she's sort of and the fondness comes over very well. It's a much more intimate portrayal of Elizabeth. Also, in a strange way, the constraints of budget make a very interesting point, because you don't have the massed crowds of soldiers that you had in the Flora Robson version. What you have is a rather sparser type of army that she's speaking to. But it does not make the point that this actually really is an emergency, because I'm not saying it's Dad's army exactly, but we haven't got massed ranks of endless troops or indeed of the sort of Lord of the Rings type of armies with CGI and what have you. So it makes the historical point, A, about the purpose of the speech, and B, about the sort of reality of the emergency, I think sort of much more realistically than any of the others. And yet at the same time, it gets the sort of intimate nature of her character and her relationship across more successfully. Right, it's a sort of rather unlikely success. And I think of all the versions, it is my favourite.
Right.
It's, you know, because you can believe in this woman. She's not the great actor of Glenda Jackson. It's not, she's not sort of on a pedestal. She's on a horse, but she's not on a pedestal. She's not this, frankly, rather unbelievable elvish character of the Cate Blanchett one. She's not the prestige, standard, old-fashioned patriotic history figure of Flora Robson. She's human. She's a real person. And yet, at the same time, you're not rejecting, you're not throwing overboard the political message and if you like, the patriotism of it as well. But it's a more believable, more humane, more understandable type of patriotic message. So I thought the BBC did a really good job there and a beautiful performance, but also really clever and very affecting script as well.
I wonder, again, I'm obsessing about the music, and it's for my two penny. The music in this one also was quite interesting in that it was kind of Celtic folky type music. It felt more intimate, more human, you know, and all that sort of thing, which kind of ties in with what you're saying. Absolutely. About the way she was presented.
And that's because there's been a sort of sea change in general sort of attitudes or understandings and coding, if you like. In the Flora Robson's time, the big stirring patriotic music was what audiences liked to hear. And so they got it. The Celtic, the idea that Celtic equals good, equals positive, equals humane on your level, had been underway, I think, for some time by the 2000s. And the classic example is Titanic, where the fact that the people down in steerage, I saw a wonderful spoof of Titanic, which made the point that we've got the Celtic Cockneys, something like that. You can either be Celtic or Cockney, or ideally both. Hey, if you're American, you know the difference. You know that then you are automatically good. Mm. And again, the fact that it's an Irish actress playing Elizabeth sort of plays into that. So, you know, you're really making use of a sort of deeply imbibed message, which is that Celtic equals good. Mm. And therefore, if you present Elizabeth, you might sort of be a little bit worried that haven't we got a rather sort of traditional British imperialist figure or something like that. But no, it's all right. And the Celtic music helps to sort of calm your fears that at least on this occasion, I know she might be a major figure from traditional history, but on this one, she's on the right side. Yeah, and the right. Music helps to sort of put that idea into your ears and into your, into your heart. But maybe that's right, yeah.
Yeah. I won't make too much comment on the deep irony of an Irish woman playing Elizabeth and a...
You're thinking Plantation, aren't you? And yes.
Yes, and an Irish man playing Cromwell.
Yes. What I was saying about actors and characters, you know, it's fascinating talking with actors about the way in which they take a character because, interestingly, actors love playing villains. And you don't, you know, if you sort of play the person everyone's going to be on the side of, it's not as challenging. But actors play villains, what they really always look for is the good side, something in there. If they're just evil, you know, Dr. Evil types, then it's very difficult not to do a caricature. What they want is the human side, the side that they can relate to, that other people can relate to. And so I think when an actor is playing someone who is so alien from their own sort of national background, as you say, Richard Harris playing Cromwell, then though interestingly the film didn't deal with the Irish angle at all.
No, it avoided it completely, didn't it?
Avoided it. But I think from an actor's point of view, that's a really interesting challenge. Or for, politically, if you have very strong political principles one way or the other and you play a major political character, you know, say someone like Mrs. Thatcher, and if you're, you know, very much on the left wing, or I suppose if you're playing someone like, Lenin or Stalin, if that's not your politics, or hey, for anyone, whoever you are, if you're playing Hitler. Very interesting challenge to take this book and make them human and make them believable. And that's what actors really like and respond to because otherwise you keep them for the pantomime.
Yeah, indeed. One last time then, let's hear Anne-Marie Duff.
I know. I have the body of a weak and feeble woman. But I have the heart and stomach of a king. And a king of England too. And I think foul scorn that Spain or any prince of Europe should dare to invade the borders of my realm. To which, rather than face that dishonor, I will myself take up arms beside you. I will be your general and your rewarder for your virtues in the field. We know that you already deserve rewards and crowns, and we do assure you, in the word of a prince, they shall be paid to you. And take heed, too, of my lieutenant general. For no prince ever commanded a more worthy or noble subject as he. By your obedience to him, by your valor in battle, we shall yet win a famous victory over these enemies of God, of my kingdom, and of my people!
Well, look, that is fantastic, Sharon. That's absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for coming on to say that. If there's any way you'd like people to go and look at some of the theatre that you do or anything, do let me know and I can put a link.
Yeah, www.seanlangtheatre.com. Sean Lang Theatre, all one word.
Great, fantastic.
And I've got a website which has got details of some of the stuff I do.
Very good. And I hope we can get together and talk about and do something to do with theatre, because I love that concept of, as I say, teaching history through drama. It's a fantastic idea. So, okay.
Right, hope so.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Sean. It's fantastic. And it's been very interesting indeed.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, I hope you really enjoyed that. I thought it was great. And remember to check out the website for those film clips on YouTube. And also, just to remind you of the link to Sean's drama site at seanlangtheatre.com. And I'll be back next week when we can hopefully polish off the Anglo-Spanish War. Good luck, everyone, and have a great week.